The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Clarisites. Tired of waiting for updates to slow dashboards that don't tell you the complete story? Tired of manually aggregating data on spreadsheets to understand your campaign performance? What if you could access all the data you need in one place, without dependencies on SQL, spreadsheets, or valuable data team resourcing? That's why performance marketers at Uber, HelloFresh, Delivery Hero, and many others trust Clarisites to run marketing reporting, automating all manual work and helping them focus on insights that drive performance. What used to take weeks now takes minutes with Clarisites. Go to clarisites.com/demo to try it out for free. You'll see why thousands of performance marketers trust Clarisites every day.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Sufer. My guest on this episode of the podcast is Russell Ovens. Russell has a PhD in artificial intelligence and began his career in academia before transitioning to industry and starting one of the first Western social free-to-play gaming studios. Russell most recently was the director of analytics at Eastside Games, a publicly traded mobile free-to-play gaming studio, where he's now a board member. And he recently published a book, Game Analytics, Retention and Monetization in Free-to-Play Mobile Games. The topic of our conversation in this episode is the structure and management of successful analytics teams at consumer technology companies. Among other things we discuss, what purpose an analytics team should serve and what value it should add, the optimal way to structure an analytics team, the difference between analytics and data science, how analytics teams fail, and who should own the LTV metric in a consumer tech company. A little housekeeping. You may have noticed that I've introduced ads into the podcast in this latest season, which is season 3. If you'd like your company to be featured on the podcast as a sponsor, you can reach out to Marketecture at info@marketecture.tv. Please enjoy this conversation with Russell Ovens. Russell Ovens, how are you today?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Eric.
Oh, I'm very pleased to have you. So when I first started my blog, I think the primary content focus was analytics, and really it was free-to-play analytics. And that has always been an intellectual passion of mine. I stopped writing about that because in some sense, it felt redundant. I felt like a lot of the stuff that I was talking about in like 2011 became, you know, just the best practice. And so there's no reason to keep talking about it. And then you also don't want to be talking about like the cutting edge stuff that you're doing at the frontier, because that's proprietary to whatever company I was working at that time. So, you know, you can't give too much away. But the other reason, it was just like very niche, right? And so the blog kind of expanded the audience and expanded the sort of content focus. And I had to kind of touch on things that are a little bit more market driven, but I really, really, really do enjoy this topic. I think there's what's interesting about analytics is if you are a product manager, there's just a wealth of information or opinion or analysis about how to do that job on the internet. There is almost nothing like that for the analytics profession. And so I'm really happy to have you on this podcast. But the sort of genesis of us talking about this was you recently published a book. So I will allow you the opportunity to promote that book in a second. But before we get there, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. So my name's Russ, and I am effectively a computer scientist by training. I have a PhD in the field from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and I've had a career that's had one foot in academia and one foot in industry, but academia didn't want me, and I was better in the entrepreneurial space, a software engineer, and then I started my own company, and that company morphed into one of the very first social game studios back in 2007, 2008, when Facebook first opened up its API to third-party developers. So my journey into gaming is perhaps a little bit unique in that I didn't set out to be there. I just landed there because of, you know, good timing and opportunity came along and we grabbed it. But mainly because I was surrounded by really smart people who were into gaming, like my employees. And so I had this social game studio. We started out doing some of the very first light gambling apps on Facebook, like Scratch and Win, Pull Tabs, and Slots. And we were all computer scientists, so our games were very well written. And we incorporated the very earliest monetization platforms, Super Rewards and Spare Change. So we had, you know, affiliated marketing for pay and microtransactions using your PayPal account. We ended up really growing that business significantly. We had the Family Feud app on Facebook, which many, many people played, millions of people played. And I wasn't really enjoying being a CEO. I, you know, preferred writing code or teaching how to write code. And so I sold that company in 2010 and left the games industry. Did a bunch of other things, was an executive in residence, went back to teaching, opened a brewery. But then in 2018, I came back to the games industry at the invite of Jason Bailey, who was the CEO of Eastside Games in Vancouver, and became kind of the head of analytics. And over time, while trying to like keep my head down and not get too involved, because I have a tendency to get too involved, before long, I was like the head of the growth team. Then I was running analytics and ad monetization and revenue and all these other things. So eventually, though, I quit. I retired at the end of 2022. I'm now on the board of directors of Eastside Games, but I took the time away to put down on paper everything I wish I knew when I came back to the industry in 2018. To your point, there's a lot of information that's kind of kept secret as proprietary. And I don't think that's either necessary or fair. It's not fair to people in the industry. It's not fair to new hires. So I, and also because of the switch to remote working, I felt like onboarding new data analysts was becoming more and more difficult. So I started out writing this book as material to onboard new data analysts at Eastside Games, but then it turned into something more complete. And I was actually very inspired by your book, Freemium Economics. In fact, I wanted to call my book Freemium Analytics, but one of the editors I was working with kind of said, nah, that's not good. And I remember you posted somewhere or said somewhere that one day some academic is going to codify all of this information and it'll be a textbook and it'll be part of the undergraduate curriculum somewhere. And I kept waiting for that to happen and it never did, probably because it is too niche, as you were pointing out. But there's been this proliferation of education programs in both data science, analytics, and in gaming. So maybe it was just time and I happened to be the one available to do it. So,
and you did it. You've alluded to the book multiple times. You haven't actually named the book, so I will do that. So the name of the book is Game Analytics, Retention and Monetization in Free-to-Play Mobile Games. I bought it, I think, right when it came out. It's really fantastic. It's I think a must read for anyone working in the game analytics space. I think it's definitely the best games analytics based book that I've encountered. And it's very, very practical, right? So it's full of SQL queries, you know, R code. I mean, you walk through the kind of like the fundamentals, but you also provide just sort of like very concrete examples of how to implement this stuff, which I think is really fantastic and that's really helpful. Okay, so I want to start the conversation with like a big high level conceptual question, as I usually do in these interviews, which is, what's the role of an analytics team in a company? What purpose does it serve and what value should it add?
I allude to that a bit in the book, and thank you for those comments, by the way. And I was laughing because the title almost sounds like I was ASO optimizing, put in as many keywords as possible about what the topic of the is. Yeah, but analytics teams, and I'll really just focus on the games or free to play industry because it's what I know best. They are the canary in the coal mine with respect to how is the product or game performing. So ultimately, they're responsible for generating the key performance indicators or KPIs that reflect not only how the game or product is doing today, but how it's likely to perform. Is it trending in the right direction? Where does it need to improve? Should this product even go to market or continue to be marketed? And by that, I mean, should we continue to be spending money on user acquisition? To that point, the marketing analyst versus the game data analyst, we differentiate between the two. We have those two roles within our organization, and that's pretty common in the industry. You have a data analysts who are focused on supporting the growth team or the marketing team, and they are primarily responsible for predicting lifetime value, LTV, and quickly measuring a return on ad spend or ROAS. And that's their primary function. If they are doing that job correctly, they are worth their weight in gold, because then the company can scale, buy users with confidence that that investment is wise. The game data analysts, conversely, are focused on improving the product. So they support product managers, producers in improving either retention or ARPDAU or both. Typically, you improve one, you improve the other. And so they are responsible for not only monitoring those metrics, but helping to design and evaluate A/B tests, looking at how we can improve the metrics on our game.
Gaming is like a very specific, you know, category of like consumer tech, right? And I think gaming, you talked about the sort of analytics team being the canary in the coal mine for like the broader health of the product, or like providing that playing that role. But I think gaming generally does that too, right? I think gaming is generally at the cutting edge of analytical methods, and particularly with performance marketing, but like analytical methods for driving increased user value, right? And so I think a lot of the methods that get established as, you know, industry norms in gaming end up, you know, being sort of syndicated across like broader consumer tech, right? So how do those, but I mean, you've seen both, right? You've worked in gaming companies, non-gaming companies. What differences do you see in terms of like the role that analytics teams play and like purposes that they serve? And then it's just the general prominence within the organization for gaming versus non-gaming companies.
I wish I had more specific experience to draw upon outside of the gaming sector. I don't disagree that what you're saying is true, that gaming's perhaps on the forefront of analytics techniques, measuring customer retention, customer lifetime value, and then those get adopted to like SaaS products or subscription-based services. Totally makes sense that that would occur. But one of the, I can tell you what I think the one of the major differences in is, and perhaps why gaming is on the forefront a lot of the technology, is that the sheer volume of the data that comes from games. Because, you know, there's a tendency to want to track everything that the user does while interacting with your app on their phone. And we do that at Eastside Games. And so the sheer volume of data is quite ridiculous, actually. And coincident with that is the quality of the data isn't always great. The, you know, events go missing, the devices, when you background it, the way the operating systems work on phones don't really give the programmer the opportunity to shut down a thread elegantly, and especially on the Unity platform. So events will go missing, they get sent in the wrong order, and or, you know, the programmer has made a mistake and a new version of the app is released, and suddenly we can't rely on certain, you know, pieces of data being correct. So those kind of challenges affect, I think, the gaming industry way more than other industries as well, because I think the release cycle is a lot more compressed in gaming. You know, like you're always putting out new versions of the product that may or may not have been fully vetted from a quality standpoint, at least in terms of the analytics that's being collected. That tends to get missed, right? Like, because it's not seen as being fundamental, which is a real challenge that analysts face when they're working on games too, right? Is that analytics data isn't considered like a first-class citizen necessarily. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I think the data volume point is a very astute one, right? So, I mean, you know, you might talk to like a subscription service and they have, I don't know, it's a scaled subscription app, right? And they're the biggest, they're the behemoth in their category, and they have like 100,000 DAU. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, that's not that big of a technical challenge to manage that and to manage the instrumentation across that. And by the way, they do an update once every 2 months, right? And there's no live content. There's no, you know, they do an app update and like all the new content is encapsulated there. They're not actually driving content updates via like sort of external configs or remote configs. So yeah, no, that's a very good point. So it's almost like it's probably like a slower pace. Maybe a lot of gaming analytics directors retire to non-gaming.
yeah, that's right. Go take it easy.
Yeah, that's the version of the beach. What's the optimal way to structure an analytics team? Because I think reasonable people could disagree about this. And I think it's very context dependent, but talk me through org structure in an analytics team. So should it be centralized versus embedded in the products? Rotating versus dedicated, how do you approach this problem?
the best success in my experience, and I'm pretty adamant that this is the way to go with, especially within a game studio that has, say, multiple games that are in, you know, live ops. You want to have dedicated analysts embedded in the games teams. And when I had a new analyst starting on, say, Trailer Park Boys, Greasy Money, one of our, you know, our biggest titles years ago, I had the analyst sit between the producer and the game designer, which, and physically sit. Like I'm a big proponent of on-site work. I just feel from a teamwork and learning from osmosis kind of standpoint, nothing beats it. Nothing beats the ability to have impromptu conversations, share a screen, discuss things. And more so, what I wanted the analyst to do was overhear all of the conversations that were going on with respect to game design decisions, live ops scheduling. So they were part of, the analyst was part of the morning stand-up. They knew what was happening and why it was important, what the priorities were. And that business knowledge, I believe, is absolutely crucial for an analyst to succeed. You can't just provide reports, dashboards, numbers, responses to ad hoc queries without really understanding how it fits into the goals of the business. And that happens, I feel, better, or it's facilitated by having analysts embedded in teams. And so we never really had a separate analytics department. I mean, there were dashed lines in the org chart, that kind of thing, but that was more for like evaluation, mentoring, those kinds of things, right? You always had to have a senior person that the juniors could go to help with if they got stuck on a particular problem. But their work was set by the teams that they were embedded in. And so we'd have a growth team and it would have one or two analysts, and we would have each game team, like a game that was large enough to have like a dedicated team doing ongoing maintenance, design, live ops, it would have an analyst embedded in those.
Did they rotate around? Did they get to jump to from game to game every 6 months or something?
Sometimes, because what would happen at, like East Side Games, we do a lot of titles with, you know, well-known intellectual properties. So for example, an analyst might say, oh, I really want to work on, you know, The Office because I love that game, or I want to work on RuPaul. AEW, we just put out a game with them. And again, people that were really interested in wrestling, they would, you know, want to be on that team, you know. But what we typically saw was that an analyst's career path would be focused on either the marketing side, like predicting LTV and ROAS, or the game data side, which is A-B testing and improving retention or ARP down. The actual games that they worked on was less important than that. And they might move around, yes, but they tend to stay within that particular trajectory.
Yeah, I've seen the same, that you get kind of siloed into one or the other. I mean, particularly because you just become more valuable to that function over time, and you know, you don't want to start over, and the company doesn't want you to start over.
Right. Like, you know, once you've been doing that job for a year or two, you have so much ingrained knowledge that the studio would be loath to kind of have you start over in a, you know, different role, because, you know, too much knowledge just goes with you.
What is the market for, I guess, employees in general for games companies, but analysts specifically in Vancouver? Because there are quite a number of gaming studios in Vancouver, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Ton. Because, you know, Electronic Arts started there. So there's been, you know, tons of spinoffs from, you know, that as an anchor. Like, is there unmet demand for data analysts in Vancouver? The answer is no. Whenever we would post, you know, a job, we would get like hundreds of applicants. Not so much in the beginning. Like, so when I re-entered the industry 2018-19, we didn't get inundated with applicants if we had an open position. And University of British Columbia, UBC in Vancouver had a master's of data science program, and it was ideal for us to like recruit from. Mm-hmm. Or people who did the master's at Emily Carr in digital media, also really good source of talent. And then also the Vancouver Film School produces people that know something about game design and all that. So, you know, it's a good mix of having the right education centers and a whole bunch of companies, that it's a very active ecosystem in terms of, you know, people working in the industry and opportunities in the industry. But what we found by like 2020, 2021, we would put out the same job rec And suddenly we were getting hundreds of applications. And it seemed to me that what happened was there was this gold rush in academia to create programs in analytics, you know, masters of data science, masters of business analytics programs, postgraduate diploma and all this. Everybody was building one. And so, and everybody wanted to work in that field. And in particular, they really wanted to work in gaming. And then, you know, when we became a remote studio, we would get people applying from all over. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it was something that I observed that I thought was pretty interesting, was that initially it seemed very niche and it was difficult to get applicants who had the right background, skill set, and interest. Mm-hmm. And over time, it's become, you know, just way too many people looking for far too few opportunities.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's good from a hiring manager standpoint. So I've worked with companies that couldn't find people locally that had any experience with gaming. And so they were faced with the choice of either taking someone who had kind of like analytics domain expertise, but not gaming industry expertise, or, you know, bringing someone in from abroad or just from outside of the region, yeah. which presents its own risks, right? They might get there and not like it, or they can't find a school for their kid or whatever. But it sounds like that wasn't an issue in Vancouver.
The not having necessarily having experience in the gaming sector was definitely the case. But what I guess is that there were far more people that had the educational background that we required for the job.
Got it. So I am going to ask you to chime in on the sort of age-old question, which is, how would you characterize the difference between analytics and data science? How did you structure those roles? What were the differences in their sort of daily or kind of weekly workflow? How did you differentiate between those two types of jobs?
I used to think this was an important question, and I devoted a few paragraphs to it in the introduction of my book, because I call it game analytics. I didn't call it game data science. And part of the reason why I did that is I didn't want to give potential readers the wrong idea that this was going to be a book about how you do machine learning with Python or something, which I do 300 pages of deep dive analytics without really touching anything that you would consider to be AI or machine learning. And the difference is this, let me put it this way. We have done some data science at Eastside Games. And by that, I mean, looking at individual users. If you are generating predictions about how an individual is going to behave or monetize in your game, that's probably data science. If you are looking at aggregate behavior of a cohort, that's analytics, right? So it's a subtle difference. You still end up doing predictions. You are doing, you know, not just descriptive analytics. You're also making predictions about what's going to happen with the players of your game. But the analysts would tend to look at it from a statistical standpoint and say, here's the likely thing that's going to occur in the aggregate for this group of users that just installed the game. Whereas a data scientist might say, let's look at the behavior of an individual player over the first, 48 hours. And then we're going to predict when they're going to churn and how much money they're going to spend within the game before they churn. That's much more of a data science kind of thing. Now, regardless, if you want to be a data analyst or data scientist, you need to have a certain skill set. You need to know statistics very, very well. You need to be able to use SQL at a very high level and do it accurately. And you need to know the business that you're working within. Beyond that, I think the distinction between the titles is pretty artificial. And there is definitely a tendency that data scientists, that title is more prestigious and you get paid more. But really, you should only get paid relative to what value you bring to the organization. And an analyst, I like the analytics approach because it's way more believable, in the sense that it's not believable, it's the wrong term. You talk a bit about in your book about black box argumentation. And analysts can't rely on that. And they shouldn't. Whereas the data scientists can go, you know, back off, I'm a scientist, you know, trust me kind of thing. And that is, I find, a little bit disingenuous. You should be able to reason about, you know, the results of your analysis and what's actionable, regardless of whether you're using, you know, the scikit-learn library in Python, or you're using, you know, fitting a nonlinear regression to a set of data points.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I had never thought about it in that way, but that's really interesting. So I've got some group, and I've got, you know, historical data that is the basis of some model of, call it associated probabilities with like what happens next. That's, yeah, very much an analytics exercise or a data science. I'm going to try to fit this individual's data, which is going to be much more sparse. I'm going to use a model to sort of like predict that at the individual level. And you can see where there's two different approaches that might be equally valid for instance, just measuring campaign ROAS, right? Or like predicted ROAS, right? So I've got the group level, and I'm just sort of taking these campaign level groups, and I'm just looking at what the recoup curve looks like for the group. At the user level, I'm saying, okay, well, this is what I think this user's LTV is going to be. And then I'm just sort of stacking up the predicted LTVs from within the group. Now there's much more opportunity for like compounded error in the individual approach, right?
Absolutely. And we've seen that.
It might sound more sophisticated, but it could also just be disastrous for that reason, right?
And it is. So when I said that at Eastside Games, we did both. While we were developing the methodology that I describe in detail in my book, which is based on aggregate cohort behavior and historical data, and how you build the retention curve and the monetization curve, and then how you can extrapolate that to predict what your days to break even is on any ad campaign. While we were doing that, we were also looking at doing LTV predictions at the user level. And then we compared the two approaches. And the LTV approach at the user level varied widely, as you just expected. It could grossly overestimate, like LTV 180, or grossly underestimate. Whereas over, like if you were to backtest it over, you know, 6 months of data or something, it might be slightly better than using the aggregate approach, which was kind of conservative, right, most of the time, but would miss those opportunities where you suddenly had a whale come into a cohort or something. But then again, you probably shouldn't be buying traffic based on with the hope of catching a whale.
Right. Yeah, of course.
So, and then of course, the other thing, which is purely pragmatic, it's really complicated to build a data science pipeline. Whereas we already had everything we needed to do the analytics of our using our data warehouse as the source of information. We didn't have to run these, you know, complicated ETL processes and fire up Python and then save the data in, you know, temporary tables and do all this kind of stuff. It just seemed a lot easier to just go about it the way we were doing things. And our analysis said that the quality of the results didn't warrant the extra work.
Yeah.
To do the whole data science pipeline.
Yeah, I feel like more often than not, when people try to get really cute with the analysis, it just ends up eating up a lot of time and not being better than the kind of just more aggregated approach.
Yeah, I all I can tell you is you should understand the aggregate approach. And then if you want to, and the last thing I say in my book is, you know, okay, so now you have the fundamentals. Where you take it from here is up to you. If you want to go into doing, you know, user level predictions, and typically where that leads to is actually changing the game slightly based on the user. So either making the game more difficult or providing different promos at different times, which are things that we've actually experimented with, and that does work. You know, like identifying, you know, lapsed spenders or players that are likely to churn and providing them incentives to stick around or make a further purchase. But you do need to understand how this all works, I think, in the statistics analytics aggregate way, where you're making predictions based on how, you know, hundreds or thousands of prior players have behaved within this game or product.
The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Incremental. You've paused advertising and performance didn't change, even though you're using an attribution provider? That's called cannibalization, and it's what happens when you don't measure value. True attribution should focus on value. True attribution measures incrementality, always on. Incremental is the only platform that measures incrementality without requiring any geolift experiments or A/B tests. Used by some of the most sophisticated companies in the world across iOS, Android, TV, CTV, influencers, and even billboards. Join the future of marketing measurement today with Incremental. To learn more, Google Incremental, the future of measurement, or use the link in this episode's description. So I think with data science, the promise of the exercise there is that you come up with some intervention that actually changes the trajectory, right? And so if you're going to do that, you're talking about a cross-functional project now.
Yes.
It's not just the data science publishing this stuff. It's actually working with the product team to design that intervention and test that intervention, right? And then optimize that intervention. And so like that, that you're just multiplying the complexity. It's not, you know, this data science is not really going to accomplish much on their own. They're building data products that are, they're meant to be ingested or utilized by some other team. And so, well, okay, the data scientist is not a lone wolf. They're not operating independently. They've got to integrate very deeply with the product team. And then product teams tend to be reluctant to kind of do that. First of all, I mean, like changing the level of difficulty, okay, that's like a, you know, that's a sort of common-ish thing to do. But other stuff like offering a promotion at the right time, I mean, that's very challenging to do just from like a political standpoint or an operational standpoint, let alone, you know, the sort of do it with like total analytical rigor.
Yeah. And it requires, you know, developer cycles.
Exactly.
Which are highly coveted. Mm-hmm. Right. And then, so you embed a tool that can do this segmentation and present different promos or different game complexity at different times to different players. That's not trivial. Right. And then, you know, add that in that you're running, say, a time limited event over the weekend, live ops, and you're trying to get all this working, you know, correctly without, you know, screwing it up. Yeah. But if you do it right, it does have significant payoff potential.
Yeah.
It does work. It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. I don't want to spend too much time here, but I just want to, because I think it's a really interesting topic. So we did something like that at when I was at Network, a gaming company called Network, and we built this. You wouldn't be able to do it now because it was dependent on, well, let me just say what it was. So basically, we wanted to show a starter pack on the basis of the ad that the person saw, right? So immediate first session promotion, essentially, for a starter pack. We needed to get the post back from the MMP, right, before we could do that. And with the ad creative ID in it, you wouldn't be able to do that now, well, at least on iOS, because you can't get that for the majority of people because of ATT. But I mean, that was doable because it was a startup, right? And so but it's still like, it was like the politics of it and getting that agreed upon by the game team was the majority of the timeline, was just managing that relationship and pushing through that. And when I see like a bigger company or like a multi-studio company, usually the way this works is, okay, well, we have this great idea. And so there's the guinea pig game in the studio. It has like the smallest revenue or whatever. And you know, the poor PM is like totally beleaguered because they're always being asked to participate in some experiment and they can never prioritize the actual like content ideas that they have because they're always having to like implement some sort of like, you know, harebrained or not idea. And so you go to them. They agree, you implement this thing, you observe it for like 2 weeks and you have some results and then, hey, this is actually really promising. This improved whatever, improved day one retention or day 30 retention or day 30 LTV by X amount. And then you go to like the next biggest studio, like, well, do we know that those results apply here? Can we assume that those results will be the same in our game? We've got a different game, we've got a different audience. And I'm talking about games now, but it could be any sort of consumer product. It's like, well, no, we think, you know, this is applicable. So you've gone months really now, you know, in time invested.
Yeah.
To the point where you're still having to make the case for implementing it in the next game or the next product. And so like, because there's just momentum behind the existing work stream, right? Which especially in gaming now, it's so oriented to live ops. Like, no, I've got all of my capacity is tied up in just getting next week's live ops event out. I have no time to implement this. And how do I know it's going to be an improvement? It might tank my day 7 retention, you know, and I don't necessarily trust this data that you're bringing to me. And so I don't want to take the risk. It gets strangely political, but I think this is an interesting idea because it ties back to what's the role of an analytics team in a company. And I guess like a big determinant of the success of these types of initiatives is how high profile is the analytics team and how much political weight does the analytics director or head of analytics have?
Yeah. No, it's remarkable how many product managers or producers don't want their games to make more money. And I say that a little bit tongue in cheek, but really there's always this fear that they're going to alienate their player base somehow. And I used to joke that at Eastside Games, our games were dictated by the customer service team, because they were the ones who would have to deal with outraged customers.
Yeah.
And I get it. You don't want to, you know, piss off everybody, but a vocal minority who probably weren't, you know, spending money in your game anyway, tend to carry too much weight when it comes to product decisions and cause fear on the games teams. There is definitely they're protective of the, you know, how pure their game is. And any effort to increase monetization is often seen as anathema to the gaming experience, right? Like as if this is something pure and not a capitalist endeavor, right? So there's always that tension. And, you know, you call it politics. I think I suppose it's political, everything is, but to me, it's common because of people's emotional attachments to the games that they play and love.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, there's definitely three questions I want to get to. So the first one is, how have you seen analytics teams fail? What are the common pitfalls within analytics teams that make them, and when I say fail, I mean not be productive. I mean not really provide sort of like the potential value that they could. And really what I mean is to not be able to add value in the sense of allow the games team or gaming, non-gaming to actually generate more revenue or to sort of like increase the value of the products, but actually just end up being like totally reactive and end up being totally bogged down with ad hoc analysis or things that don't really improve the commercial prospects of the company. How have you seen analytics teams fail?
You alluded to one, you talked about trust. And if analytics team does not have the trust of its stakeholders within the organization, so to make that concrete within a game studio, say you have an analyst who's working on a games team and they say, you know, okay, that change you made in the previous version, it resulted in a significant drop in D1 and D7 retention. And the producer or game designer might say, either don't care because the change they made was something that they believed in their heart was good and true because they were emotionally attached to it. And they say, well, I don't trust you. And you know, we know the data is bad, you know, because there's always this struggle to make sure that the data that you're collecting is accurate and complete. And then there's also a lack of trust sometimes if an analyst ever makes a mistake on an ad hoc query or report, which will happen. And so the lack of trust that can develop over time because of a combination of poor software engineering in the client that's not instrumenting the analytics hooks correctly, or you're not collecting the right data, or it's incomplete, bad queries that result in invalid results that are presented to the team as gospel. Those can erode the trust in the results. And once you've lost the trust of the team, it's very difficult to get it back. And then really all you are doing is providing KPIs that nobody really looks at that point, because any changes that they make to the product are based on emotion rather than data. They're like, oh, I think we need to have this daily login reward because, you know, I think it's cool and this other game has it. And okay, well, so they put it in and then, you know, well, did it actually improve anything or did it tank your monetization because you're giving away too much, you know, hard currency to your regular players? You know, well, no, you know, they'll just say, no, I think it's good. And okay, so, and then even trying to design a test. So let's say we want to push back on that as an analyst and say, okay, well, let's build an A/B test. And then again, you need developer resources to do that. A/B tests require programming typically, and invariably it's done incorrectly the first time. So you're dealing with a very much an uphill battle here at that point. So those are ways that I've seen teams fail. But another way is really just not understanding the business that they're in. And it's remarkable how many analysts that I've worked with over the years who don't actually play the games that they work on. Like, that's fundamental, right? Like, if you're working on a product, at least use it, be a customer so that you can think about the data, that how it might relate to the experience of the customer And there's a lot of analysts who, you know, they romanticize games. They want to get into games. They come to work at a free-to-play, you know, casual, hybrid casual company. And they're like, oh, I don't play those games. I play, you know, I'm a hardcore gamer. I play my AAA console games. And these games are dumb. Well, you know, you might want to turn that attitude around and in a hurry, right? I don't know if you've probably seen that, Eric, when you've gone into game studios and work with teams, that there's a surprising number of people who work in game studios that don't play the games they work on.
Yeah, or to your point, they, not only do they not play them, they are actively hostile to that format of games, right? Which is interesting, because I mean, I don't know that like analytics roles as such exist. I mean, I'm sure they do, but for like the game teams at like a AAA console game, first of all, the development cycle is, you know, multi-years before anyone's even playing it. So they're not really making like game design decisions based on user feedback and data. I mean, I know that there are analysts at these companies, but they don't really fulfill the same role as an analyst at, you know, kind of like a scaled consumer tech company, right? Like you'd find at a Spotify or a Facebook or whatever, a Zoom, that are sort of like help assisting the product development process with the analysis of data, right? Like at a AAA gaming studio, that role just wouldn't exist.
It does when they move into live ops, right?
Yes,
like, you know, FIFA or those kinds of games where,
right,
you know,
right, that's right.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. This has always been, I don't want to say maybe controversial is the right word, but I guess it's just like a fraught question, you know, when considering it internally at the companies I've worked at and advised and consulted for. It. Who should own the LTV metric in a consumer tech company? I'm assuming everyone in the audience knows what LTV is. I don't think we need to go through that. If they don't, well, they should buy your book. But you could also, there's multiple articles on Mobile Dev Memo, but who should own the LTV metric in a consumer tech company?
I'm going to ask what you mean by own. Do you mean like who's responsible for making it grow, or who is responsible for measuring it, or who's like, is it somebody's OKR in their quarterly assessments? Like, what do you mean by own?
Very good clarifying question. I mean, own the model and own the presentation of that metric, own the calculation of that metric.
Oh, well, yeah, that's simple. Then it's the analyst, and in particular, it's the marketing data analyst. LTV is, you know, unlike, say, ARPDAU and retention, which is the game data analysts. And as you know, retention times ARPDAU is LTV. You know, so you've got the game data analyst who's focused on what's our retention curve and what's our ARPDAU. And we really, that's all we ask the producers of our games to focus on. You know, don't look at top line revenue, ignore how much user acquisition spend is going on. Don't worry about your DAU. If you build a game that has good retention and good ARPDAU, the growth team will do the rest, right? So you focus on those things. Those are things you can control and measure, and you can look at them on a daily basis. Whereas LTV, as you know, takes time. It's a retroactive, you know, cohort metric. The marketing team owns the LTV prediction, and it's based on these, you know, hyper-focused models of how past users have monetized and how we can then use that to predict what they're about to do for a new cohort that's been acquired from on this platform through this ad network. You know, what do we expect they're going to do over the next 90 to 180 days? That's the marketing team, the growth team.
Got it. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, LTV is fundamentally a marketing metric, and the marketing team should own it. And the marketing team should be the primary customer of it too.
Yeah, it is, because they're the only ones that it has direct input on how they do their job.
Right.
Whereas it doesn't for, say, a game designer.
Right. Yeah, because it's synthetic, right? So the game designer should be focusing on the components of it, which are, you know, mm-hmm. monetization and retention conceptually.
Yes.
So we're going back to your trust comment. I've seen, you know, the LTV metric be the source of immense discord at companies.
I want to ask you about this because I've heard you say on more than one occasion, LTV is political. And to me, that's like, that makes no sense, right? Like LTV is LTV. You know, you pick a day in the future, measure it, and that's your LTV. You can't argue with it and say, well, no, right? I mean, it's like facts shouldn't be political, right? So explain to me why you think LTV is political, and I'll tell you why it isn't.
Well, it so of course it's context dependent, right? It's not the metric. The metric is just, you know, the derivation of some number, you know. But what is political is the way it's derived, right? So here's some examples I've seen, right? So you're using the wrong model, or you're using the wrong payback period, right? Or you're borrowing a model from, like, early on in soft launch, you're borrowing a model from a game that's not related, right? And it's just invalid to use that underlying model to push our data into that underlying model.
That's predictive LTV though, in that case, right?
But that's what I mean. Right. I'm talking about predicted. You're not accounting for game updates that'll improve our DAO over time. You're not calculating the ads contribution correctly. And that's actually much bigger. You know, you're not accounting for the proportion of payers to increase over time. Like, so it's usually it's coming from the game team, right? Because the LTV is not large enough to accommodate more ad spend. And so they're not getting enough growth in the game. Right. So that's where I've said that there's tension. Right. But the issue is, you know, and what I've, you know, I wrote this in a post many years ago, and I kind of like repurposed it recently on LinkedIn. And I said, like, look, the purpose of the analytics team is to provide the word of God, right? Like, where no one ever has any doubt in the veracity or the validity of these numbers that are being presented. And the second you introduce any doubt, the analytics team becomes like Tableau, like high level, like basic KPI producers, right? And what I've seen is, like, once you lose that trust, it almost takes a personnel change to get it back. It's like, okay, we got rid of that person and we brought in someone new, and then this new person will be way better, right? And so the issue with the LTV stuff is, like, once you and the kiss of death for an analytics team is when the game team goes out and they get some sort of SaaS product to predict LTV, or they hire some sort of consultant. They say, look, I know you're the central analytics team, but guess what? I've got this person who worked with King, or they worked with Supercell, and they're highly recommended, and they're going to come in and they're going to calculate LTV for the game because we don't think you can do it right. That's the kiss of death. That relationship is unrecoverable. That relationship is totally defunct, and it's going to take some sort of personnel change, or, you know, just, you know, act of the executive team to change that.
Eric, I would argue that the product has long been in trouble if the team is going out to try to find someone else to tell them that it's not. Right. That it's not that the analytics team has received the kiss of death. I think it's that the product is drowning, because I have seen exactly what you're talking about. And particularly when, you know, like in the past, Eastside Games has partnered with a lot of external studios. And so they're very invested in the game's success and ultimately increasing, because Eastside Games pays for user acquisition, increasing our UA budget based on LTV predictions. So in that regard, sure, it's political, but just because your ego is at stake here doesn't mean that the publisher should bankrupt itself spending money where it knows it's not going to see a ROAS, right? So it may be political, but really it's up to the people who control the cash to be comfortable, right? And so, yeah, some people's, you know, feelings might get hurt because, you know, they poured their heart and soul into this game and they really believe in it and they think that you're not giving it a fair shake. And we've seen that, definitely. I mean, everybody has his work in the games industry. But at Eastside Games, if anything, we tend to be hesitant to kill products and projects, because we really do, you know, want people to succeed, and we want, you know, that the product to be given every chance. Now, I'll be pragmatic for a second and say that, you know, to some of the points that you've raised quickly, I'll say this: you put out a new version of the product, it fixed a bunch of bugs in the loading, and suddenly your D1 retention is improved. What you can do is, with pretty high degree of accuracy, you can calculate a new retention curve, right, based on the new early signals. And you can estimate what you think your average ARPDAU is going to be based on players on this new version of the game. And you can do that pretty quickly as well, right? And in the last chapter of my book, I do this exercise. I go back and say, okay, what if we just looked at the first 7 days of data for a game? And extrapolating a new retention curve and multiplying, like taking the integral of that, or the summation, to come up with the number of player days, distinct days that a new install is likely to play over the first 30, 60, 90, 180 days. Multiply that by what you think the average ARPDAU now is, And there's your LTV estimate. So you don't have to rely on historical data for a buggy version of the game that you released in soft launch. You can make predictions from early signals that can help, I think, assuage the fears of both the people spending money on user acquisition and the games teams whose, you know, emotions are tied up in the success of this product. So, okay, I will agree with you that in that context, it can be political because people's livelihood or their careers depend on the success of a title. And at the same time, you've got an analytics team that's telling the marketing team, you can't really spend this much money on this game. You really shouldn't. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose that money. Right. Yeah. So that's tough. It's a tough position. It's a tough position for the analysts to be in, right? Because they get yelled at by both sides.
Right. Yeah. So maybe political is not the right word. It's probably, I would say that the LTV metric or whatever, the derivation of LTV can be the source of a lot of hostility given the a disappointing value.
Yes. Totally. Yeah. And I mean, that's difficult. It is. It's tough.
It's also just life. And it's like one thing I always used to tell the PMs is like, look, you get a couple shots on goal in your career, really. I mean, it takes a couple years to build a game. Wouldn't you want to move on? If this demonstrably wasn't working, wouldn't you want to move on? Right? Wouldn't you want to move on to some greenfield opportunity that might be a hit? You really want to sit here and split hairs over LTV for a game or a product that seems unlikely to ever really reach product market fit? Is that really how you want to spend your time? Because you could say, you know, we could do that for the next 6 months, or you could just start something new.
And then there's the sunk cost fallacy, right? It's like we spent right. $3 million developing this game. We got to give it a shot. We got to spend at least $1 million on UA to give it a chance. Right. So now you've lost $4 million.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. 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 Okay. I said I had three questions I want to ask. The last one I'll kind of pitch as sort of a lightning round or, you know, first word that comes to mind type proposition. Who should a director of analytics report to? And by director, I mean just the most senior analytics person. Who should they report to?
Nobody. They should be the CEO.
There you go. I agree with that. All right. Well, Russell Ovons, this was a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate your time. The book is Game Analytics. I highly recommend it. Again, it just comes with a lot of practical examples that will be very illustrative in implementation. Russell, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks, Eric.